From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. Why don't you subscribe? I urge you to subscribe to it today. I think you'll be glad you did. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, things I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. They include public discussion of the disappearance of a Washington Post writer last seen entering a Saudi Arabian embassy, revolving around the financial benefits the U.S. derives from the Saudis, rather than what it means for press freedom, freedom of thought, and freedom of expression around the globe, including right here at home. The same goes for the entire back page of the Washington Post this past Thursday, where a long and rambling paid screed signed by, quote, a reluctant anonymous, and addressing Donald Trump directly with language such as, and I'm quoting, "Mr. President, you may think you chose to run for president, but I am one who believes you didn't choose. You were chosen. Just like God chose Moses to lead the Israelites out of Egypt." End quote. And while I guess that kind of reasoning suggests there's not much point in voting, after all, God'll choose the winners, I didn't think I'd see in my lifetime the extreme voter suppression efforts on display in North Dakota for Native Americans, in Georgia for African Americans, and elsewhere in this country. At least there are courts that are still upholding the fundamental right of Americans to vote. But there are an awful lot of judges being rushed through the confirmation process right now, and I'm not sure how much longer the beleaguered judicial branch will be able to stand up for a right that so many bled and died for. Never thought I'd see those. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
We have to take up this moral slack, this moral void that is now gaping in front of us, that we need to fill it up with justice.
For a brief moment, senior White House advisor Stephen Miller was the public face of the Trump immigration policy. Now, that didn't go so well. But the 33-year-old ultra-conservative is widely understood to be incredibly influential in how this administration approaches policy on Muslims, on refugees, and on other groups vilified by the alt-right. Not everyone thinks that's a coincidence, including Miller's childhood rabbi, who has spoken out forcefully and publicly. On this week's show, I'll talk with that rabbi, Neil Comus Daniels.
Ultimately, we are all agnostic. This is to say you can't know whether or not there is a giant entity running the show or choosing to not run the show. You can't know.
It certainly serves some divisive agendas, the creation of a religious versus reason competition. But truly, there is so much more to it than that. On this week's show, we'll explore this idea with Scott Shea, author of the new book, In Good Faith, Questioning Religion and Atheism. But first,
You know what? I'm not going to get into it because we won. It doesn't matter.
Well,
we won.
The downward spiral of the rhetoric dominating this year's election campaign just keeps going and going. Some of it is coded for extremist elements of the electorate. Some of it is blatant fear and hate mongering. But all of it sounds profoundly un-American and feels profoundly depressing. But it's not like we can hide our heads under a pillow until November 7th, and so we need to focus on identifying and responding to the most egregious instances of line crossing in campaign rhetoric. And to do that, I'm joined once again by Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. Jack, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Welton. I'm glad to be here and glad to be on this side of the mic instead of the other.
In a recent message to Interfaith Alliance members, you urged them to speak out against the rhetoric this president is using at his almost daily rallies. Angry left-wing mob, he says, too dangerous to govern. Talk about what you wrote in response, if you would, Jack.
We're extremely concerned, Welton, that we have a sitting president now whose preferred method of communication seems to be to throw red meat to the base and not to act as a healer and a unifier as past presidents have understood their role to be. We as Americans are indeed used to this kind of rhetoric during campaigns, but the campaign cycle seems to have shrunk. Whereas it used to be every couple of years for the House of Representatives, every 6 years for the Senate, and every 4 years for president, President Trump began campaigning the day after he took office. He formed a campaign committee almost immediately for 2020. And as a result, his promotion of himself for a second term has defined in a negative way the way campaign rhetoric is being used throughout the year.
Mm-hmm. What triggered the writing this time? Why did you feel it was so important to sound the alarm this time?
I think what really pushed us over the line was his mocking of Dr. Blasey Ford in her testimony at the Kavanaugh hearing. Independent of whether you consider her testimony or his testimony to have been more credible, this reminded us of his mocking of the disabled reporter early in his campaign for president. And we simply will not allow, as a faith organization, will not allow that kind of disrespect and disregard for another human being to stand.
Jack, in your mind, how is the rhetoric that we're seeing in this campaign season different from what we've seen in past years?
I think that this time around, we are seeing a much lower target that candidates in general are aiming for, in large measure because they've seen it be so effective on a national level. And it's not that there have not been nasty campaigns in the past, and it's not that there haven't been simply awful false allegations leveled at opponent candidates. But this year in particular, it just seems that people are going there immediately. I'll give you a quick example. I live in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and Senator Tim Kaine is being challenged by County Board President Corey Stewart for his position. Mr. Stewart, in a debate with Senator Kaine, talked about his concern that settlement payments to sexual abuse victims in Congress were not being revealed. The fact that there were settlements were revealed, but not who perpetrated the acts. And in the course of that, he made this sort of casual inference that Senator Kaine himself was guilty of such acts. Now, never mind who you support, the Democrat or the Republican. The fact that he went there with something that was both personally insulting and completely without evidence is an indication of how awful campaign rhetoric has become.
Hmm. A lot of people are drawing a line between the incivility and even cruelty in political rhetoric and hate campaigns among some Americans. How strong do you see that connection as being?
What I'm seeing, Welton, is that there seems to be no limit to where campaigns will look for effective rhetoric. If they see that something is mobilizing a group of voters or a potential voters, they will embrace it and adopt it and deploy it. And by the way, it is true not just of negative campaigning, but of the abuse of electronic media. I, for example, got an email. I won't name the candidate because, once again, we're not a partisan organization. I got an email from a candidate for the United States Senate, from one of the senator's representatives, saying that I had been specifically mentioned in a conversation with the senator, and would I please send some money? I've never met that particular senator, and that senator would have absolutely no reason to know who I am. And yet, here we were with someone who was looking to separate me from my contribution, giving the impression that there was something far more personal about it than there could have possibly been. This is just wrong. It's dishonest. It's not transparent.
Well, a lot of analysts see a direct connection between the rhetoric that we're hearing from this president and how candidates for lower offices are campaigning this year. You've mentioned that already. Do you think the way the president is talking is influencing the way other people are talking?
I don't envy the calculus of a candidate who's trying to figure out where the sweet spot is to get elected or reelected, either supporting or opposing the president, either Democrat or Republican. What I'd love to see, which is different than what I'm seeing right now, is a wholesale acceptance by candidates on both sides of the aisle that the level of political discourse needs to be raised closer to issues and farther away from personalities. The latter position, the personalities, is what people are learning from President Trump. The better position, the issues position, is what we recommend from Interfaith Alliance. People I've spoken with are extremely frustrated that at the very least they have to respond to this rhetoric, whether or not they deploy it. And ignoring it doesn't work because with social media, with high-profile spokespeople willing to repeat semi-truths and outright falsehoods, the candidate who ignores what would have been a crank attack stands the risk of being labeled with the stink of whatever has been represented. So the people I know are extraordinarily frustrated, and even the more so because, you know, on both sides of the aisle, campaigns are no longer run by candidates with an independent streak. They're run by vast organizations, which build their reputation on the basis of whether they can get somebody elected. And so there's an enormous frustration with the system in general, not just the rhetoric of this campaign cycle.
Jack, this may sound strange, but when I was in Washington, I always felt like that whatever was going on that was really important, you could almost feel it in the air. Is all of this campaign language and the back and forth biting, do you feel that in the air in Washington?
So I'll talk not about the air, Welton, but the traffic. All of our listeners will remember Arlington Memorial Bridge as the location over which the procession that bore the casket of President John Kennedy went as it headed toward Arlington Cemetery. Arlington Memorial Bridge has needed repair for a lot of years, and we finally are underway. It's a six-lane bridge, three in each direction, but in order to repair it, for the next 2 years, they've closed down half the bridge. So in the morning, there are two lanes going inbound and one going outbound, and then it's the opposite in the afternoon. What's happened now is that traffic that used to roll smoothly over that bridge, even during rush hour, has been squeezed into options that are not only limited, but somewhat dangerous. Lanes are narrower, and you've got a car coming directly at you, even if it's only at 20 miles an hour. That's a great metaphor for what's going on in Washington. There's less room for people, less room for the positions they want to stake out, and it always feels like somebody's coming straight at you, ready to do you harm. So yes, you can feel it in the air, and you can see it on the streets.
It's always been a core election year mission of Interfaith Alliance to educate both candidates and voters on the appropriate separation of religion and politics in electioneering. Are you seeing problems with this in this year's campaigns?
Well, we always see problems with campaigns, as you know, Welton. It's a little more pronounced this year because the deployment of religious faith as a weapon in a campaign has become so much more commonplace, and particularly a certain kind of religious faith. So, yes, we're seeing a problem with that. There has been tremendous interest in our five questions to ask candidates about religion in politics and in government. Your listeners can find that on our website under our election materials. And we are extremely concerned. We've reached out to a number of candidates. Again, I won't name names, expressing our concern about the way they've been using religious rhetoric and about the way, in some races, it's actually a battle between the faithful. You know, who's a better Christian? Who's more faithful? Who is closer to the constitutional ideal of religious freedom and free exercise? So it's a tough year.
Not surprised, but I'm glad that you're doing exactly what you're doing. Jack, you lead a national religious freedom organization. You're a faith leader, have been for a long time, but you're also a husband, a father, and a grandfather. So let me ask you, what keeps you up at night? What worries you the most about the moment that we find ourselves living in?
I have to say, Welton, that even if it doesn't quite serve the mission of the organization, it is not politics that's keeping me up at night these days. Ever since the Kavanaugh hearing, I will tell you that all of the women in my life have been distressed because it dredged up things that they remember. My daughters each have had their Me Too experiences. My wife has had her Me Too experience. And I suspect that even though she hasn't talked about it, my mother's had an experience like that because she too was just horribly disturbed by what went on in the Kavanaugh hearings. And she's 90 years old, God bless her. So what worries me is, as an adult male, first of all, there are parts of my youth that I'm now forced to revisit and think about how I behaved when I was in high school and college. And I'm also not certain what I can do beyond sympathizing and offering my support to make things better. I'm past the point where I have much influence on people. And it's not for me to fix as a man. It's for me to stand beside and behind the women who are leading this movement and looking for the necessary fixes to our society to make sure that we don't have another generation of women who universally suffer at the bad behavior of people like me.
Jack, we have to have Interfaith Alliance. We have to have Interfaith Alliance vibrant and doing the work that it's always been doing. How can our listeners support that work right now, today? Tell them what they can do to help.
First of all, as always, we are grateful for contributions that come to us either through our website, interfaithalliance.org. There's a big donate button at the top, or in response to the direct mail that I know many of your listeners receive. So that's the first thing. But here's an innovative idea that comes from a member of our team, Donna Deaton, who has taken a look at how we are soliciting membership and raising our funds. You know, it's not too soon to start thinking about what you're going to do for the holiday season in terms of a gift for the people you know and love, especially those people who are your children and your grandchildren, and who might not be inclined at this point in their life to become affiliated with an organization like Interfaith Alliance. Buy them a gift membership. Send us a note, and we will send them a welcoming letter as members of Interfaith Alliance and make sure that they're getting the information that we send out all the time and that they connect with this organization so that when I'm ready to join you in full retirement, there will be another generation willing to step up and pick up the gauntlet and move forward in this incredibly important fight for religious freedom.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, defending true faith and freedom. Jack, as always, it's great to talk with you, and thanks for you taking some of your time to talk with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Always glad to be here.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Stephen Miller's childhood rabbi took the very unusual step of publicly chastising the White House immigration policy master. I'll ask him why. And up next, Scott Shea. His new book is titled In Good Faith. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Religion versus secularism. Looking backward versus looking forward. The ways people of faith can be divided from people of no faith are endless and often painful. Challenging this dichotomy is a new book titled In Good Faith, Questioning Religion and Atheism. And I'm intrigued to welcome the author, Scott A. Shea, to State of Belief Radio. Scott, thanks for being with us today.
It is a pleasure to be with you, Reverend Gowdy.
Religion's role in the world, you seem to be rebutting those who argue it shouldn't have one. Is that an accurate way to put it, or do I need to be corrected?
One of my main points in the book is really understanding what religion is and what faith is. And I think that we all tend to believe in something. And the question is, what do we believe? And societies either fall into idolatrous modes, which is they may claim to be secular, but they have to be very careful not to fall into idolatrous modes, which is belief in a set of lies about power.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, it's ascribing superpower or super authority to finite beings, peoples, individuals, corruptible individuals, elements, or ideologies. So we may have thought we licked idolatry in the polity 3,800 years ago with the god King Pharaoh, but Mao ordered 30 million people to march to their death, and they did because they thought he had the authority.
Mm-hmm.
Stalin sent tens of millions to the Gulag, starved half of the Ukraine, and nobody questioned his power or authority. And we see time and again, obviously what happened in Nazi Germany, Pol Pot, and I could go on and on with abuse of authority. So I think that we almost always have faith in something. And the question is having a good faith, having faith in something that's good for humanity and consistent with what I think is God's wishes for us on this earth.
Mm. Well, around here, we certainly recognize the role of religion is unavoidable and often, very often, a force for good. I wish you would talk about your take on interreligious cooperation now as you've experienced it and how that informs this book.
Well, I started this book because I thought that faith and belief had been marginalized. I thought that, frankly, that the new atheists were winning in terms of in the marketplace of ideas. And so I felt like I had to write this book, but, as you know, I'm Jewish, and I just felt that there was something more fundamental to belief than even one of the monotheistic faiths. So when I started writing this book, I made a point of having long detailed interviews with other monotheistic thinkers. So I spent time with Cardinal Dolan here in New York, with Reverend Bishop William Murthy, who's also a Catholic bishop, Father Alex Carlustos, who's a presbyter of the Greek Orthodox Church. But then I also talked to Reverend Dr. Calvin Butts, who's in the Southern Baptist community. Reverend Dr. Calvin Butts was just an amazing person to learn from. I interviewed Reverend Dr. Chloe Breyer, who's an Episcopalian.
Mm-hmm.
and I interviewed Imam Shamsi Ali and Chaplain Tahir Ahmed, who's one of the leading female Islamic faith leaders in the U.S. So I wanted to get these other voices in because I didn't want this to be a Jewish book. I think belief in God, in one God, in a monotheistic God that we all share by whatever name, is basically too important not to figure out what unites us as opposed to what divides us.
Your book is described as, quote, a rebuttal to atheists. I'm hoping that's somewhat of an oversimplification, but I want you to talk about that, please, what that means.
My book is about why it's rational to believe in God with all we know in the modern era about science, the historicity of the Bible, and our sense of modern morality. So I don't think anybody can prove there is a God, and I don't attempt to do that. I attempt to what I say in the book is that I get that atheism is rational. It's rational to believe that there's no God. But I show that it's just as rational with everything we know, as I said before, to believe in God. And what's more, I show that the evidence that we have from both the universe, science, and from history and humanity is consistent with belief in God, and I think more consistent with belief in God than consistent with atheism. That's not to say that atheism is irrational. What I came to do is to show that and to demonstrate that, unlike what is said at some university classes and by the new atheists, that it is not stupid to believe in God. It is not that we are clinging to superstition. It is not that we are uneducated, as some would argue. We, as believers, are actually at the forefront of questioning, at the forefront of you know, frankly, the whole scientific revolution to a great degree. And there's nothing to be bashful about. There's nothing to apologize about. So I wrote the book to be able to stand up to academic scrutiny.
I see. What do you see as ways people of faith misunderstand atheists and the way atheists misunderstand people of faith?
I think that there are two types of monotheists and two types of atheists. I think there's the monotheist who recognizes that he or she needs to grapple with God's message through the scriptures, through everything we know about God, and that we're living in a world of tests. We're living in a world where we need to figure things out, where nothing is simple, but that's part of God's plan. And then there's a second type of monotheist, in all candor, who I think is a sort of semi-idolatrist monotheist. This is a monotheist who parks his or her reason at the door and says, I'm following X leader. That could be rabbi, reverend, imam, whoever. And I don't need to think. I'm going to just do whatever they tell me to do. And that, frankly, in my view, is prohibited by the way we Jews count it, the third commandment, the way most Christians count it, the second commandment, which is not taking God's name in vain. And to me, anytime someone sets themselves up as the sole spokesperson for God, then they become essentially idolatrous, and their followers are idolaters. So that's the two categories of monotheists, and we need more of the former, more of the folks who are willing to work hard and reason and take the scriptures seriously. And then on the other side, you have two types of atheists. And here, I'm desirous of making common cause with what I call the golden rule atheists. The golden rule atheists are those who believe just like what described as the golden rule by Hillel, which is, and others, there's many people have said this in different words, but he said, don't do unto others what you wouldn't want done to you. The rest of the Torah, the rest of the Bible is commentary. And there are some atheists who take the golden rule very seriously, and we take it as believers seriously, because we believe that every single person is endowed with some divine spirit, some spark of divinity. And Golden Rule atheists believe that everybody in a certain sort of way shares humanity. And so they go by the Golden Rule. But I have to tell you, I've met a lot of not-so-Golden Rule atheists, too, in my life. I talk in the book about a mid-level trader at Salomon Brothers when I started my career who explained to me his philosophy of life, which is what was good for him is good. And it doesn't really matter what's good for anybody else. He was what I call a Machiavellian atheist, which to me is very similar to idolatry. Machiavellian atheists essentially make themselves idols, and that's when really bad stuff happens. It happens on a personal level, and then, of course, it can happen on a societal level where Kim Jong-un or whoever it is becomes an idol, and people have to do whatever he says to do, or people abuse their positions of authority when it comes to power in corporations, power in sexual abuse and sexual harassment, et cetera. It's something that we really all have to be very mindful of.
Scott, I wish I didn't have to say this, but I've met a lot of non-Golden Rule Christians.
Oy.
I mean, what you have just described, I understand, but that is not just an atheist characteristic. It is a characteristic, I think, for some people in almost all religions.
Well, if they believe, as the Bible starts out, that every single human being on this planet was made in the image of God, in other words, has that divine spark, then I would argue not being a Golden Rule, I would say it's essentially a non sequitur. You can't be a Golden Rule or an oxymoron. You can't be a non-Golden Rule Christian, because then you're, to a certain degree, frankly, an idolatrous Christian. And you would be an idolatrous Jew. You know, we've had red-handed rabbis, too, so I don't want to not declare that. We have plenty of problems in the Jewish community, too, where people self-justify themselves and, as I said, set themselves up as sole spokespeople, or only my group is a spokesperson for God. And when you do that, again, it's dangerous. I think that's when bad stuff happens. When you say that someone else, just like Pharaoh, had no problem throwing the Israelite baby boys into the river, it's because they didn't count. They weren't part of the God, King, Pharaoh's group. And the same thing happened with the Hittites and the Assyrians and the like. I mean, we've seen that in ancient history. The Bible says this is really where there's big danger. The 20th century, unfortunately, was a poster child for idolatrous, mostly atheistic, but also Christian and monotheistic, and it's a serious problem.
Scott A. Shea is a successful businessman who has worked on matters of faith and ethics throughout his life. His new book is titled In Good Faith, Questioning Religion and Atheism. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, and thank you for all of your good works and your leadership.
A lot has been happening in our nation that could be considered inappropriate, even profoundly inappropriate, in ordinary times. What makes things more difficult is how many Americans, regardless of alliances and allegiances, have come to believe that we live in extraordinary times indeed, and so conventional rules often go out the window. Without making a rule on the action itself, I was fascinated to see the childhood rabbi of senior White House advisor Stephen Miller condemn the young advisor publicly during a Rosh Hashanah service. The response has been widespread and diverse, and so I wanted to hear from the man at the center of the story, Rabbi Neil Comus Daniels. Rabbi, thank you so much for joining us on State of Belief Radio.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Would you start by just describing what, from your perspective, you wanted to convey by speaking to Stephen Miller?
Well, what I mean, my message was basically to my congregation, because Stephen Miller, as I've found out, is almost impossible to reach on a personal level through the screens that the White House puts up. Uh-huh. But I wanted my congregation to know that not only should they have their gut responses to Stephen Miller's actions and their outrage and so on and so forth, but also to know that there are places in Jewish tradition and in the Torah specifically that will bolster that response and put them and, you know, give backbone to their any actions they may take and so on and so forth.
Why did you feel it was important to take this unusual step?
Well, I felt that it was, something that unfortunately, like so many issues that come up in our society, it depends what page it's on in the newspaper or how prominent it is as, breaking news on the TV. It ebbs and it flows, and I really felt that because of our mandates and our tradition and what it asks of us and what it urges us to do, that we definitely had to be those who are out there trying to heal this situation. In fact, in the sermon I said, I invited Mr. Miller in and said, we're going to clean up this mess, because apparently you're not, but you could change your mind and join us at any point.
As I understand it, the congregation understood this step that you take. I'd like for you to describe the community that you lead.
It's a wonderful, small, but vital community that has been, very involved in being creative and on a journey to explore what their spirituality is, and always, always, always how that intersects with our daily lives and the lives of our nation, and certainly the world, so that we have a Judaism that isn't just isolated within ourselves, that it always speaks to the larger community.
Mm-hmm. So has it been strange to see the kind of far-right zealotry Stephen Miller is promulgating on the national stage, considering the environment in which he grew up?
Well, I mean, he was only a member of our congregation for a couple of years at most, when he was about 9 or 10. So I don't really have, much any recollection, really, of him. I mean, I think what's so outstanding about that is how un-outstanding it was, or it is. But I understand that he made his sharp right turn later in his life. And I wish that he had hung around more with us, and I would have been able to at least share my perspective and share my message with him, of embrace and inclusiveness and kindness and mercy, so that at least he would have had that on his table as a choice. And in the sermon, I also said, I mean, I really have no idea what the state of his Jewish identity is now, and whether or not that guides him in any kind of way, or whether or not he cares, to be honest. But I do. Sure. I care that any person, but specifically from my role as a rabbi, I care that a Jew in a prominent position is doing these things that I think are completely antithetical to the values of Judaism.
Rabbi, would you talk about what you see as the role of a faith leader such as yourself in an age such as this?
Ultimately, our role as clergy in America is to scream our values out. The separation of church and state doesn't mean that the religious community is supposed to be silent. It means that we have a right to say what we want to say and put it out there in the mix and try and hold our elected officials and our unelected officials, like Stephen Miller, to a higher standard that transcends the political machinations that may be going on at the moment.
This story made headlines around the globe. What would you say to those who disapprove of what they say is too political an action by a Jewish faith leader?
First, I understand their perspective. And then I have to say that separating parents from children, ripping children away from their parents, is and cannot be a political issue. Those are not political footballs to kick around. Mm-hmm. That's a spiritual issue. Mm-hmm. That's a values issue. It may get decided in America, the system that we abide by and love and respect. It may get worked out in the political arena, but it's incumbent upon clergy to make sure that the spiritual values of all of these issues are ever present and that people aren't allowed to move away from them.
You have a long history of interfaith activism. Would you talk about how that might inform your sense of the place of faith in the global political conversation?
Well, it actually began at the Riverside Church in New York.
Hmm.
I was a rabbinical student, and there was going to be a large gathering of many faiths there for a spiritual gathering that would then lead into a march to the UN, an anti-nuclear weapons march.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine in seminary said, well, you play guitar and sing, go sing something Jewish. So I did, but that was, you know, the least of what happened to me that day. What happened was that I was overwhelmed by all of these people there pushing in the same direction, and as I'll never forget this phrase, that we all made a pledge to be peacemakers instead of peacekeepers. And then, you know, I was walking and singing with some young men who were training to be priests, and I'm training to be a rabbi, and it just began to all come together and to recognize that there's a voice here that I needed to be part of.
I think there was a criticism because you did this on Rosh Hashanah, and it makes me want you to talk about how in your ministry these kinds of events, social political events, become as important as do the historic liturgy and the theology by which you operate.
Well, first of all, at a very pragmatic level, just like many other religions experience a surge of population at a certain time of the year. I wanted to make sure that I took advantage of that and mm-hmm. spoke to as many people personally rather than through the internet or anything else mm-hmm. that I could. And, you know, the controversy over this sermon, I think it pales to the time that I brought a local imam and a local person who does the call to worship for Islam.
Mm-hmm.
I brought them to Yom Kippur services and had them you know, do the call to worship. This was at the time when the mosque was being blocked from being built near the site of the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And so I honestly exploit those opportunities because I think that's when the Jewish community is gathered. And that's when we really can give feedback to one another. That's when we really can have a discussion. That it's not just these, you know, isolated barbs flying back and forth across the internet. This was an opportunity for people to really be with each other and to respond to what I had to say. No one says they has to agree with it. On the other hand, I think it's really important that when we gather for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we always admit or recite our wrongdoings in the plural. You know, the way Abraham Joshua Heschel said it, that in a free society, some people are guilty, but everyone's responsible.
Mm.
You know, we can't say, well, I have nothing to do with that. I'm not close to the border. I can't you know, really affect what's going on with these children who are now spread across the United States and so on and so forth. No, it's my responsibility.
Sure. Well, in light of the past few weeks, is there anything else you would add to what you said publicly to Stephen Miller?
Yeah, I would. I would say that obviously he and the administration have gone further, limiting and punishing people for trying to come to this country and begin their freedom journey. It's really kind of amazing to me. Next week, we read Lech Lecha, the beginning of Abraham's journey. Mm-hmm. We don't even know why his father Terach began this journey, but Abraham crafted it into something else. And, you know, at Passover, when we talk about Abraham, we remember that he was a wandering Aramean, and that we have a, as Jews, we have a thick history of being refugees in the world, you know, that we've been, as Marge Piercy puts it in a beautiful poem, that we were strangers in Egypt, and we've been strangers in all of the lands of the world since. And that gives us a certain perspective. We're supposed to see society and see the world through those glasses of moving from slavery to freedom. And somehow, I think Mr. Miller took those glasses off.
Rabbi Neil Comus Daniels leads Congregation Beth Shir Shalom in Santa Monica, California. At Rosh Hashanah, he made global headlines with a public condemnation of the anti-immigrant work of White House senior advisor Stephen Miller, who, as a child, attended the school at Beth Shir Shalom. Rabbi Comus Daniels, it's been great talking with you. I thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion that's going on there. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. I don't know what I would do without him. I don't know what this show would do without him. What a good guy and what an excellent producer. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.